Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kathy Curtis, a certified financial planner and investment advisor and principal of Curtis Financial Planning. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Joe Keefe. Joe is president and CEO of Pax World Funds and its investment advisor, Pax World Management, LLC, as well as its majority-owned subsidiary, Pax Elevate Management, LLC. Joe has been a force in the field of sustainable investing with key leadership roles at New Circle Communications, the Calvert Group, Citizens Advisors, and U.S. CIF prior to joining Pax World Funds. He is an outspoken champion for women's empowerment, and has not only written and spoken widely on the topic, but is a strong advocate through his work with the UN's Leadership Group for Women's Empowerment Principles and Women's Thrive Worldwide. He has received numerous awards for his work, including this year when he was honored by the United Nations with the Women's Empowerment Principles Leadership Award. Please help me to welcome Joe Keefe.
Thank you, Kathy. Good afternoon, everyone. I really appreciate Kathy Curtis and the Business and Leadership Forum and the Commonwealth Club for the invitation, and it's great to join you this afternoon. I'm going to speak about investing in women, or what we call it, my company, Pax World, gender equality as an investment concept. I'm going to start with a quote from a book called The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, and this quote, I think, captures what the international development community has understood for some time about investing in women and girls. And he wrote, quote, "The best clue to a nation's growth and development potential is the status and role of women." Now, that quote is from a learned historian, and it speaks to a nation's growth and development potential. And today there is a strong consensus in the international development community that the most important strategy for alleviating poverty and promoting sustainable development around the globe is to invest in women and girls. CARE, one of the world's largest humanitarian relief organizations, puts it succinctly on its website where it says, quote, "We place special emphasis on investing in women and girls because our six decades of experience show that their empowerment benefits whole communities." Now, the international development community has understood this for some time, but there is also an emerging consensus that the status and role of women may also be an excellent clue to a company's growth potential, that the best companies, and therefore the best investments, are those that take advantage of the talents, ideas, and contributions of half of the world's population. In fact, numerous studies have now shown that companies that empower and advance women are likely to reap the benefits in terms of improved performance and profitability. I'll just recite a few. A 2012 Credit Suisse Research Institute report of 2,300 global companies found that companies with women directors on their boards outperformed those without women directors in return on equity, average growth, and price book multiples, and that those companies with at least one woman director had better share price performance than those without women directors. A 2013 Harvard University study, quote, does the gender of directors matter, concluded that boards that had a critical mass of at least three women directors on their board were approximately twice as likely both to request further information and to take initiative compared to boards that did not have such diversity. In other words, they simply asked more questions and asked for more substantiation. Consistent with these findings, the study also found that the return on equity and net profit margin of those companies with at least three women directors was also significantly higher. A 2013 Thomson Reuters study reported that amongst 4,100 publicly traded companies globally, on average, companies with no women on their boards underperformed relative to gender-diverse boards and had higher tracking errors, including more volatility or risk. Further, the study found that indices of companies with mixed gender boards had better or similar performance to benchmark indices. A 2011 Catalyst study found that companies with three or more women on their boards had higher return on invested capital, higher return on equity, and higher return on sales than companies with no women on their board. I could go on and on and on, but you get the picture. There's mounting evidence that gender diversity has positive financial consequences, that gender equality and women's leadership could begin to be understood as investment concepts. When women are at the table, the discussion is richer, the decision-making process is better, management is more innovative and collaborative, and the organization is stronger. This is particularly the case with a critical mass of women in leadership roles. They bring new perspectives, they consider different issues when making decisions, and tend to use a more collaborative leadership style, increasing win-win problem solving. At the same time, women are more likely than men to ask tough questions and ask for more detail, and as I said, substantiation. For these reasons, and I quote from another study, a critical mass of three or more women on corporate boards can cause a fundamental change in the boardroom and enhance corporate governance, close quote. In the July-August 2010 issue of The Atlantic, in an article called The End of Men, Hannah Rosen wrote, quote, "It could be that women boost corporate performance, or it could be that better performing firms have the luxury of recruiting and keeping high potential women. But the association is clear. Innovative, successful firms are the ones that promote women. Investing in companies that advance women, therefore, is simply a smart investment strategy." Yet today, women hold less than 5% of Fortune 500 CEO positions and only 16% of board positions in the Fortune 500. Whereas women comprise nearly half of the workforce, they account for only 14% of senior executive positions. In the financial services industry where I work, or some of you work, it may even be worse. A mere 10% of traditional mutual fund managers are women, and only 3% of hedge fund managers. There is some evidence, moreover, that the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009 might not have been as severe had women been in leadership positions. For example, there's some support for the proposition that women in senior executive positions, including women fund managers managing investment portfolios, may be more risk-averse or at least take a different approach to risk than do their male counterparts. One study found that overconfidence amongst single men investing in common stocks resulted in widespread overtrading, as much as 60% higher than single women, leading to reduced gains, increased turnover, increased costs, and increased portfolio instability. In general, women tended to hold their investments longer and invest in holdings where there was less expected variance or volatility in investment results. Another study looked at managers of U.S. equity funds from 1994 through 2003, a nine-year time period, and documented similar differences between male and female fund managers. Women managers tended to take less risk and to follow less extreme investment styles, which are more stable over time, while male managers had a more active style, higher turnover, and more volatility. In the New York Times, Sunday Times, of, I think it was 2.5 weeks ago, it was actually October 19th, there was a piece entitled, "Are Women Better Decision Makers?" And it summarized the findings of Professor Therese Houston, a cognitive psychologist at Seattle University. And she finds that as stress levels increase, women take less risk and make better decisions than do men under similar stress. In research experiments, and I quote, "stressed women tend to make more advantageous decisions looking for smaller, surer successes. Not so for stressed men. Their decision-making becomes more questionable, risking a lot for the slim chance of a big achievement." So most of the research, it's not suggesting that women are smarter, or that they are necessarily better decision-makers or that they are necessarily better managers than men, but it points to the simple fact that more diverse groups make better decisions and provide better management and governance than non-diverse groups. Following the financial crisis in 08 and 09, New York Times columnist Christoph was writing from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, and he wrote, quote, "Some of the more interesting discussions revolved around whether we would be in the same mess today if Lehman Brothers had been Lehman Sisters. The consensus is that the optimal bank would have been Lehman Brothers and Sisters." So it's becoming increasingly clear that what we might call the gender diversity gap looks to be, or closing, I should say, the gender diversity gap, looks to be a very profitable proposition. It, in other words, is not only the right thing to do, but it's the smart thing to do. If advancing women into leadership positions, therefore onto boards and into management, makes businesses more profitable, ergo, we should be investing in that as well. So how can investors do that? How can we fashion investment strategies that capitalize on what women have to offer to the bottom line? How can we truly make gender equality an investment concept? So my company has asked itself these questions, and I think we have found some answers. First, if gender diversity on boards and in senior management is material or relevant to a company's prospects, as the evidence I have cited suggests, then it clearly makes sense to integrate these factors into stock analysis, company analysis, and into investment portfolio construction. Yet very, very few managers across the country do this. Based upon the above evidence that, again, that I've cited, I would suggest that these managers are leaving money on the table. At Pax World, my firm, we have long integrated diversity analysis and other gender criteria into our research and into our portfolios. We favor investments in companies with diverse boards and management teams. We try to avoid investing in companies that fail to provide a safe work environment for women, or that encourage or tolerate harassment, or that have a history of pattern of discrimination, or who are involved in the exploitation or trafficking of women, or whose products demean women or use negative stereotypes in their advertising, promotion, or marketing. We also offer a specific fund, the PAX Elevate Global Women's Index Fund, which is the first mutual fund to invest in the highest rated companies in the world for advancing women's leadership. That is to say, the highest rated companies in the world for representation by women on their board and in senior management. The fund was launched in partnership with Elevate Asset Management, whose principal is Sally Krawcheck, one of the most respected individuals in the financial services and one of the most visible, articulate, I think compelling proponents of women's leadership in the business community. So investors can invest in funds that pay attention to this issue. Investors can invest in funds that integrate gender into their analysis. Second, investors actually have, all of us actually have, each of us as an individual actually has, a lot more power than we realize. We actually can say no to all male corporate boards, and in fact, we have an opportunity to do so each and every year when companies hold their annual general meeting and send out their proxy to shareholders in advance of the annual general meeting. Sometimes people say, well, it's terrible that women have such small board representation in the Fortune 500. Who owns these companies? We do. They're in our IRA. They're in our 401k at work. We invest in mutual funds or stocks. We own these companies. We're their shareholders. These boards are supposed to represent us. So at Pax World, we have a proxy voting policy for all the companies and all of our portfolios. That's thousands of companies. When we receive the proxy in the mail, we will not support any slate of directors that does not have women, and in most cases, we will not support a board unless it has at least two women on it. When we withhold support, we then register our concerns by writing a letter to the company, explaining the reason we oppose their board was because of its lack of gender diversity. We encourage them to adopt a program in their nominating committee for embracing gender diversity. And we'd let them know that we'll be staying in touch and we'll be engaging with them and we'll continue to work on this issue. And if need be, we'll file shareholder resolutions with other investors to try to bring this to the shareholders' attention if they fail to move. During the last proxy season last year, we withheld support from 134 board slates because of their lack of gender diversity. Since 2010, we have withheld support from board of director nominees at more than 800 companies. So this is a very simple step that any mutual fund, any pension fund, or any money manager can take if they want to promote gender diversity on corporate boards. And yet, the overwhelming majority of them don't. So they're essentially rubber stamping all male corporate boards supported by management all the time. What a missed opportunity. If you believe that women should be better represented on corporate boards, but you are invested through financial advisors or other financial intermediaries that rubber stamp all male corporate boards, or perhaps don't even vote your proxies at all, then you are unwittingly part of the problem rather than part of the solution, or at least your money is. I would suggest that you think about switching to a firm that better reflects your values and your priorities. My company is also a founding member of the 30% Coalition. The coalition is comprised of industry leaders, including senior business executives, national women's organizations, institutional investors, corporate governance experts, and others, that seeks to assure that women hold 30% of board seats across public companies by the end of 2015. We're not going to reach it by the end of 2015, but I do believe we're reaching a tipping point on this issue. And when it falls, it's going to fall. Just like the Berlin Wall took 50 years to fall, and then it fell in Eastern Europe, went democratic in the next 6 months. Just like marriage equality took years and years and years, but all of a sudden when it started to happen, it happened. It's going to happen on this issue. The coalition, the 30% coalition, we sent letters to more than 160 companies in the S&P 500 and the Russell 1000 indices that do not have any women board members. Those letters were signed by institutional investors who represented more than $1.2 trillion in assets, along with major women's organizations across the country. And since the letter-writing campaign began, we've not only got responses from many companies, but approximately 20 of those companies have appointed a woman to their board of directors. We also have a separate shareholder engagement campaign that involves sending letters to all of the companies within our funds, asking them to endorse the Women's Empowerment Principles, which is a joint project of the United Nations Global Compact and UN Women that seeks to create a standard for how global corporations treat women at work. Finally, we file shareholder resolutions, often in coordination with other concerned investors, asking specific companies and their board nominating committees to adopt charter language implementing a gender diversity policy immediately. So, investors can make a difference, or we can make a difference as investors. You can invest in funds that, in turn, invest in portfolios where gender is considered. You can insist that those representatives who you invest through who vote your proxies at companies' annual general meetings vote them in favor of diverse boards. You can participate as active shareholders and engage companies, urging them to advance women into leadership positions. There are all kinds of things we can do. And in fact, of all the things we can do to have an impact, whether it's voting or volunteering for a nonprofit or driving a Prius or all the wonderful things we can do to try to make the world a better place, if we do all of those but we don't do it through our investments, we're leaving the most powerful arrow of all in its quiver. That's our most powerful leverage, money. And I might mention another very important reason why integrating gender factors into your investment decisions makes eminent sense. There's a large and growing market in the U.S. Women outnumber men in the attainment of college degrees by 20%. 72% of valedictorians last year were women. Since 1982, women have earned 9 million more associates, bachelor's, and master's degrees than men have. 45% of American millionaires now are women. And by 2030, it is projected that roughly two-thirds of the nation's wealth will be in women's hands. Women are already the breadwinners or co-breadwinners in two-thirds of American households. They own more than 40% of all U.S. businesses. They're responsible for 83% of consumer purchasing decisions, et cetera, et cetera. Newsweek magazine called women, quote, the biggest emerging market in the history of the planet. So what we're ultimately talking about is fashioning investment strategies that are responsive to and take advantage of this mega trend. The best managed companies in the world are those that are ready to take advantage of the myriad contributions that women can offer. Conversely, holding back half of the world's population through unequal educational and job opportunities, unequal wages, let alone violence and oppression, is not only morally reprehensible, it is just plain dumb economics. We also need to pay attention to what women are beginning to say about investing, because they don't invest in exactly the same way that men did. One often hears of a gender gap in politics, with women identifying more as Democrats and men more as Republicans, a trend that has actually been evident since the early 1980s. On public policy issues, women tend to favor a more activist role for government in guaranteeing health care, basic social services, are more supportive of gun control, same-sex marriage, legalized abortion. Essentially, women's views over recent decades have trended more moderate to liberal, while men have trended more moderate to conservative. Not surprisingly, these attitudinal differences play out when it comes to money and investing as well. Women are more inclined than men to want their investments to be aligned with certain social and environmental values. A recent U.S. trust survey of high net worth investors asked how important social, political, or environmental impacts were in evaluating investments. Such impacts were considered somewhat or extremely important by 63% of women compared to only 41% of men. Another survey found that nearly 42% of women compared to only 27% of men reported that they are likely or very likely to make environmentally responsible investments. A 2014 TIAA CREF survey found that 70% of women were interested in investing money or investing more money in socially responsible enterprises compared to only 55% of men. In a report called Harnessing the Power of the Purse, the Center for Talent Innovation recently found that 90% of women in a global survey want to invest in companies with diverse leadership. It also reported that there were significant discrepancies between men and women in their desire to fund gender equality, diversity in leadership, and environmental performance. So this gender divide is real. Women, it seems, are more inclined to want their investments aligned with their values, while men are more likely to compartmentalize investments over here, moral and political values over here. Whereas men tend to view money as ethically neutral, women generally have stronger feelings about the social and environmental impacts of money. Indeed, they are more willing than men to even accept a higher risk or a lower return on investments in companies that have positive impacts on society. Fortunately, there's no need to accept lower returns or higher risk. Studies have shown that companies with positive environmental, social, and governance attributes are often better financial performers as well. Women are simply onto something. So if financial advisors are going to serve this fast-growing market, they better be attuned to the gender gap in investing. 70% of women today fire their financial advisor within 1 year of being widowed. Financial advisors who had been catering to the husband all those years may simply not understand the differing needs or attitudes of the wife. While the husband may have been focused on the highest possible return, his widow may prefer a more holistic investment approach. For women, investing is often about more than just money. It is about their families. It is about the future. Rather than simply chasing higher returns, they may actually prefer to invest in a way that is consistent with their values and integrated with the rest of their lives. So we are at a historic juncture. The demand for full equality between the sexes is reverberating across the globe. Each and every week, whether it's the captive schoolgirls in Nigeria, or spousal abuse in the National Football League, or the CEO of Microsoft making controversial remarks about women seeking pay raises, or the Nobel Peace Prize going to a young Afghan girl who stood up to the Taliban for the simple right to attend school, the issue is before us, and it's not going to go away. When I speak around the country on this issue, in fact, I'm often asked, why do you, as a man, care so much about this issue? And I actually think that's sort of like asking a white person during the 1960s why they were supporting civil rights, or a black South African 25 years ago why they were supporting Nelson Mandela and the struggle against apartheid. The fact of the matter is, there is still a system of Jim Crow laws. There is still a system of apartheid in place around the world when it comes to women and girls. In one place, it might be honor killings. In another place, it might be genital mutilation. In another place, it might be women aren't allowed to drive automobiles. In another place, it may be a young girl is subjected to horrific violence for the simple act of trying to attend school. But it's a continuum across the globe. Here in the United States, it's women earning 78 cents for every dollar a man earns, and it's women holding only 16% of Fortune 500 board seats in the year 2014. This is the greatest human rights issue of our age, and it is also the greatest economic issue of our age. It is the defining issue, in my view, of our time, perhaps along with climate change. They are both existential issues, and I think they both speak to whether the human prospect is going to be a success or a failure. Eliminating gender equality and empowering women need to be recognized on a global basis for what they are, urgent moral and economic imperatives. This is as true for businesses and investors as it is for broader economies. Gender equality has to become an investment concept. We need to make it an investment concept. And the next decision really is ours. We can either take advantage of this opportunity, this obligation, or not. Are we going to invest in gender equality and women's empowerment, or are we going to make the mistake of ignoring these vital trends, these vital needs, these vital moral and economic imperatives? We have a choice in the way we invest. We can take advantage of opportunities, or we can ignore them. We can be part of the solution, or we can be part of the problem. When it comes to advancing women and women's leadership, it really is time for investors to become part of the solution. We may not be able to directly put a halt to honor killings or genital mutilation or protect a young girl in Pakistan on her way to school, but we can send a message that gender inequality is no longer acceptable. And we can enlist publicly traded corporations, multinational global corporations, in the fight. We can get them on our side. We can get them on the side of women. And those companies can send a signal to the rest of the world, again, that gender inequality is quite simply no longer acceptable. And to paraphrase Robert F. Kennedy, by doing so, we can at least send out tiny ripples of hope. And those ripples can build a current, which maybe can sweep down the mightiest walls of inequality and oppression, so that perhaps what we do here in our own little way can be felt elsewhere. And by changing American business, which controls the global economy in many ways, we can send a signal that no longer is gender equality, inequality no longer acceptable, but perhaps in our own way move the needle and make a difference that affects the lives of women and girls around the globe. It seems to me that that's an opportunity for all of us as investors and an obligation of all of us for human beings, as human beings. Thank you very much.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to The Business Case for Gender Diversity with Joe Keefe, President and CEO of PAX World Funds. I'm Kathy Curtis, and now I will lead a Q&A with Joe. Joe, thank you so much for your being such a great advocate for women's empowerment, and you've made such a great case how important the issue is. There was a lot of discussion about women on boards, and I have a question. So questions from the audience about what about women in executive suite and senior management positions? Yeah. Is it that you have more ways to impact women on boards through proxy voting. Is that why you focus on that, or can you talk to that a little bit?
That's a great question. You cannot affect women. You cannot impact women in executive suites through proxy voting. Of course, you only have a right to vote on their boards. You can, however, now that pay-to-play is in effect and that investors have an opportunity to vote on executive pay packages in major corporations, you can begin to address inequities or pay disparity between the genders. No one's figured out quite how to do it yet, but I think there's an opportunity that wasn't there a few years back. In our Global Women's Index Fund, we look at both. So, for example, in our Global Women's Index Fund, the average representation by women on the boards of those companies is 31% of the board seats are held by women, whereas the global average is only 11%. And the average representation by women in senior management is 24% versus a global average that is, again, coincidentally, 11%. So much higher representation. And the hope is, this is self-serving, obviously, but the hope is that as investor money goes to a fund like this that's investing in the best companies in the world for advancing women, that will create sort of a virtuous circle. Other companies will be incented to do better themselves. And then over time, companies will do better because the companies aren't doing as well. We'll see that investors are choosing the companies that are doing better. That, after all, is the way markets are supposed to work, right? It's not like a crazy idea. And we're hoping the fund can help do that.
Okay, given that there are the small percentage of women on boards, executive suites, how hard was it to build that fund and find companies that passed your screen?
It's difficult, but you know what's interesting? And this isn't like a little sort of niche fund composed of all these crazy companies that are just outliers. This is a global index fund comprised of 400 global blue chip companies. It's Microsoft, it's Google, it's Walt Disney, it's Pepsi, it's Coke, it's General Electric. These are blue chips. So these companies are, what we believe is because these companies are global, large companies, once this index has a history, and it's only 4 months old now, we'll be able to make an apples-to-apples comparison between the market as a whole and those companies that have greater representation by women in leadership. And our bet is that those companies with greater representation of women in leadership are going to outperform precisely for the reasons I talked about. All the research suggests that they should outperform because those more diverse leadership groups are going to make better decisions, and over time, investors in those companies should do better than investors in the rest of the marketplace.
Were there any companies that surprised you that you thought you might put in the fund and didn't because of the gender issue? Or if you don't want to name names, are there any industries that seem to be worse offenders than others?
Yes. So if you build an index like this, you want to beat the world global indices, but you're going to be challenged during some periods because, for example, the allocation to energy in our index is very low because in the energy sector, there's just not good gender diversity. So when energy is doing really well, we're going to underperform a little, or at least that part of our fund is going to underperform a little.
All energy or just the big
The big integrated oil companies, okay, for the most part. Another good example is Japan. Japan, less than 1% of companies have any women on their board. Yet Japan is probably about 7% or 8% of the global index. For us, it's much lower. It's like 1% because we couldn't find any companies really that met our criteria. So you're going to have some anomalies like that. But on the other hand, Kathy, there are certain industries, particularly consumer industries, consumer durables, consumer staples, and so forth, where women are better represented. In fact, you could argue highly represented. And when those sectors do well, when those companies do well, we'll outperform. So it will depend upon differing markets. But the interesting thing about this index, too, not only do we think it will outperform, but compared to the global index on which it's based, MSCI World Index, it has lower risk. So it's going to be less volatile in volatile markets.
You spoke about the investment industry being woefully underrepresented with women, when we all know that. There's 17% women are advisors. And so how did the banking and investment industry do as far as women on boards and executive suites?
It doesn't do real well. Financial services doesn't do real well.
Okay.
Financial services in Europe do better when it comes to women on boards. Financial services in the U.S. do a little better when it comes to women in senior management, interestingly enough. I don't know the reasons behind that.
Okay. So the financial industry has a long way to go on many, many levels when it comes to gender diversity.
It does. It really does.
And women traditionally have been gone up through the ranks in banks. So, you know, the banking industry is pretty female dominated. They're just not getting up there in the senior suites and on the boards. And
I think that's true. I mean, it does better than some industries. It's not the worst outlier by any means, but it's challenged, particularly when you look at the number of women that are now in financial services.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know.
Yeah. Okay, so I know my clients ask about proxy voting, and a lot of people think their one little proxy vote is not going to make a difference. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, there have been proxies that have gotten a majority vote at shareholder resolutions at companies that have gotten a majority vote on a lot of issues. If you look at issues such as asking companies to disclose their greenhouse gas emissions, if you look at issues such as companies adopting non-discrimination policies for gay and lesbian employees, if you look at companies on gender diversity, what's interesting is they don't have to carry the vote and get 50% plus one to win. What happens is if they get 15 or 20 or 25%, the companies start listening and they respond. So look at these boards of directors at these corporations. Their job is to represent the shareholders. Now, I realize too often they represent really the insiders, the managers, but their job is to represent the shareholders. And ultimately, they have to listen to what the shareholders are saying. So if the shareholders en bloc, en masse, start to ask for something, eventually their wish is going to be granted. And that's the power we have to realize that we have. These are publicly traded corporations. The public owns them. We own them. And as I said, if we leave that arrow in our quiver, but yet we go out and vote and we go knock on doors for a candidate and we volunteer for a nonprofit, but we take the most powerful leverage of all and we do nothing with it, shame on us. We're not prioritizing the right things.
There are other companies that are sustainable investing is very important. Are any other firms, competitors, focusing on this issue like PACS at this time?
I think, there are some, you know, most of the shareholder resolutions we file on this issue, a lot of the letters we write, we do it with a lot of other institutional investors, mostly in the sustainable investing arena. Also, a fair amount of religious investors, a lot of nuns, I love the nuns, are very active on this issue. They're always on the right side of every issue. there are a lot of others to do it. I mean, we have the only Global Women's Index Fund. I think that's unique. It was the first index and the first fund. But a lot of the shareholder engagement around the issue has been done by a lot of firms in our space, some of them represented here in this room, for a long time. Yeah.
So stepping away from the board issue and women in companies, there is a global gender gap index study done by the World Economic Forum in 2013. It measured gender gaps on economic, political, education, and health in the U.S. The U.S. ranked overall 23. I mean, for the most powerful country in the world, that's pretty dismal. But even worse, on the wage gap, it ranked 67. So this is such a huge issue. Women continue to be underpaid, 70 cents to the dollar, all that. I keep reading that in younger generations that's changing, like millennials, women are starting to get closer. But it's so persistent. Now, in the study, they also quoted a bunch of experts. And one of the things that keeps coming up is family policy, that women, you know, their careers don't advance as fast because they leave for a while to have kids or they go part-time. What is your feeling about that, about family leave policy?
Well, when you read the pages, the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal, and whatnot, you always hear this. Well, there's a wage gap, but that's because women leave the workforce to have children. Of course, they're going to, you know. Yet if a man left and went on a sabbatical to, I don't know, sail around the world, he'd probably get credit for it when he came back. I just think that the excuse really begs the question, and it's really, you know, you hear the same thing about, well, we would put more women on our board if we could just find qualified women. And then you ask, well, what do you mean by qualified women? Well, we mean women who have been CEOs. It's like half the men on your board haven't been CEOs. Why do women have a higher bar to jump over? You know, so I look. Companies have to have policies such that women are not punished if they take family leave, whether it's 3 months or 3 years. And I think there are ways that companies have to. You know, the wage gap is not going to close unless companies affirmatively decide to do something about that. Now, some companies are, but to just accept it, like, well, they took some time off for families, so of course they're behind, it strikes me as preposterous. I mean, you know, the data shows that when women are at the table, decision-making processes differ, okay? They're more collaborative. They're more innovative. They ask more questions, blah, 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 blah. You don't think some of that came from raising families and being mothers? It's the diversity of experiences that you're supposed to be getting and rewarding. So I just find that whole sort of series of excuses just preposterous.
Well, it's sort of the S word, sexism, which is still pervasive, I think, and that's a real problem. Did you read, there's a great New York Times article by Claire Kane Miller entitled, "The Motherhood Penalty is the Fatherhood Bonus." And her first sentence was, "One of the worst career moves a woman can make is to have children." And she went on to write about this double standard that still exists in most companies about mothers and fathers. And to your point, until that changes. Now, will companies do it themselves? Does there need to be more government regulation?
You know, I haven't seen, but I would like to see some research on what happens to males who take time off to be caregivers when they re-enter the workforce. I'd be willing to bet my house that the wage gap is not as great, but I don't know that. But I think that's the type of data we need to, you know, to finish getting at this issue, because I think what she wrote is correct. It is, if you look at what's happening with wages and compensation right now, it is a bad career move. And that's why I say we are affirmatively going to have to do something about that. It's not going to go away on its own because the world is just becoming a better place. I mean, it's going to take pressure on companies. You know, this is a great book. You've probably, a lot of you have read it, Lean In, by Sheryl Sandberg. And it talks about, you know, how women have to sort of be more assertive in the workplace. It's a great book. But I gave a talk shortly after it came out called Lean On, because I think we have to lean on companies to get them to improve. Yes, women have to do what they can within the corporate sector, within companies, to advance themselves and so forth. But, you know, it's kind of blaming the victim at some level to say that all you have to do is lean in. I mean, these companies need pressure to do this. And it's not necessarily because they're bad people or the bad. Look, I'm a CEO. I know every day I come into my office, I have 15 more things to do than I can do. And I have to triage every day, and I have to prioritize. And so what we've got to do, we, the royal we, all of us, is to make this a priority for boards, a priority for CEOs, a priority for the companies we own. And like I said, you don't necessarily have to win a shareholder resolution. You can bring one, and it gets 15% of the vote, and all of a sudden they're paying attention. We have to get them to prioritize this. If it became a priority to address the wage gap, if it became a priority to address gender inequality on corporate boards, I think you would see the needle move very quickly. And I really believe we're at a point where we can make that happen over the next, you know, in the short term, over the next 3 to 5 years. But we have to resolve to do it. It's not going to happen on its own.
Yeah, you know, I guess the message is we all have to realize that we are shareholders in these companies. There is one area, though, that I think is really lacking, the 401k industry, because there are very few 401ks that have sustainable funds that may have these kind of issues as a priority, and that's where most Americans invest their money, right?
Right.
So I don't know. Is that changing, or are there inroads in?
Well, I think that's the 401k plans and 403b plans in the nonprofit sector that have sustainable options or ESG or socially responsible, whatever language you want to use, have done so by and large because it's been requested from their participants. So if at work you have a 401k plan and it doesn't have any of these funds, you can request it. And it's sort of like what I just said a moment ago about you don't need to get a majority vote on a shareholder resolution to win. You know, if an employer gets 2 or 3 requests, they think it's like a wave coming. They don't test it to see whether that was a majority or not. They start to get requests, and they look at it's a natural thing to want to be responsive. These plan sponsors and plan administrators who are doing this work want their clients to be happy. If their look at, we have a 401k at my firm, we requested that these funds be in it. Mm-hmm. The administrator that does our 401k plan doesn't get that request from all of their clients. They've told us, however, that they're doing more and more of it because they're starting to talk to their clients about it. Again, you've got to put the issue forward. You know, it's not going to sort of happen because someone else is going to make it happen. We have to make it happen. And I think with women and millennials in particular, and I cited some of the evidence about how women approach investing differently than men do, very similar data or research is out there now about younger investors, millennials. Women and millennials want their investments aligned with the rest of their lives. It seems to me that with so many women in the workforce and younger workers, we could, again, in a very short period of time, we could create sort of a tipping point in the 401k marketplace, but we have to request that these funds be added to these menus, and it will happen.
So proxy voting, 401k, and then I'm thinking another one might be, if you know which companies support women, is buy their product and don't buy the product of the companies that don't. Of course, that's hard to do if oil companies are, you know, the worst offender and we all drive our cars. But
yeah, it's tougher to do as consumers. But look, at one of the things that is a little frustrating in the investment world is consumers have been sort of voting with their feet and with their purse for quite a while now, whether it's organic food or buying products that are fair trade and so forth. And a lot of the people that are doing that and buying, you know, organic products, fair trade products, products that come from a supply chain that doesn't have any child labor or so forth, some of those same people just have their money with some plain old investment advisor that's doing nothing. So their consumer decisions and their investment decisions are at odds. So we need to take the same approach to investment. I think people are a little bit more. They feel, oh, my 401k, and I don't know about money. My 401k administrator knows. My investment advisor knows. But they're your agent. They represent you. You can request what you want. And that's we've got to get people to start insisting that their financial intermediaries take simple steps that could be taken, very simple, to move their portfolio from one that completely ignores this issue to one that integrates this issue and other environmental and social issues that you care about. It's easy to do, easier than you'd think.
Great advice. We only have time for one last question, and there's a couple of questions from the audience about racial diversity in addition to how important that is, too. How do you take that into consideration?
In our women's fund, we focus on gender. In all of our portfolios, when we look at diverse boards, we look at gender as well as racial diversity. And there's not as much research on racial diversity and financial performance right now, curiously, for some reason, as there is on gender. So what is happening is that on gender, people are beginning to hear the business case more. On racial, ethnic, other diversity, there's not as much out there yet. In the sustainable investing industry, we've been looking at it for a long, long time. We've been integrating it for a long, long time. There is no fund that I'm aware of that focuses on it yet. I think there will be. I think the research suggests that diverse groups make better decisions. And I think the same sort of rationale that why groups with women in them make better decisions than men is also the same reason why diverse groups racially would make better decisions than all white groups and so forth. There's not as much data on that yet that I'm aware of. We collect everything at PAX, but I think the premise is the same. Different experiences, different backgrounds, different thought processes that have come as a result of culture, background, history make for better decision making.
Okay, and on that note, thank you so much, Joe Keefe of PAX World, and talking about the business case for gender diversity. And now this program of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Thank you.